Now, as Paul Thompson said there, radio today is up against many other media for our attention these days, and that includes online services on our digital devices. And while radio has indeed adapted to lots of new technology down the years, those online services are now changing faster than ever, and some of the most profitable and fastest growing companies in history are fueling that. Earlier this month, the founder and chief executive of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, gave the media a bit of a jolt when he suddenly rebranded his entire company as Meta. And then he announced that he's building a virtual metaverse for us all to live in digitally. And this is how he introduced the world to that idea in a special video as a kind of cartoonish avatar of himself.
Whoa, we're floating in space?
Uh-huh.
Who made this place? It's awesome.
Right? It's from a crater I met in L.A.
This place is amazing.
Boz, is that you?
Of course it's me. You know I had to be the robot, man.
I thought I was supposed to be the robot.
Whoa.
And while that was Mark Zuckerberg's way of introducing us to the metaverse, there were also videos of contrived chats between Mark Zuckerberg and his own employees as part of that rebranding PR package.
So one of the most important aspects will be live service games that launch updates and new downloadable content regularly, like Echo VR, Beat Saber, Onward, Pistol Whip, and more. Beat Saber has a passionate community.
Oh, I love Beat Saber.
So do I.
Well, Beat Saber, by the way, is a kind of virtual reality game created in the Czech Republic, set in this futuristic world where beats of adrenaline-pumping music fly at you and you have to slash them with a digital sword. Sounds like fun. Anyway, it seems that Facebook even talks to its own people like this. Here is part of a leaked internal video that Facebook's HR department made for its American staff who suddenly found themselves working for Meta earlier this month.
So that's what's gonna change. Jump into the metaverse.
Oh, yeah. Be sure to review what's changing on the People Portal and decide what benefits you'll need for 2022. If you don't actively enroll, your current benefits will carry forward, except for your FSA contributions.
Who wouldn't want to work for Meta? But while Mark Zuckerberg was pointing to an upbeat new forward-facing vision, Facebook has a bit of a PR nightmare on its hands right now in the form of all the fallout from the Facebook files. That was from whistleblower Francis Haugen, who teamed up with a PR agency and 17 separate media outlets. And her leaked information about Facebook failing to confront the damage that it knows that it's doing to its own users, with things like bullying, hate speech and misinformation, that made headlines all around the world. Delivering this year's BBC Reith Lectures, which will be broadcast in early December, artificial intelligence expert Professor Stuart J. Russell said that what was happening with Facebook now was worse than Chernobyl, as a wake-up call. Now, in the audience that day at the lecture was Rory Kethlin-Jones, who this month retired after covering technology for the BBC since before Mark Zuckerberg founded Facebook in his university dorm room way back in 2004. And Rory has written all about it in his new book, Always On, Hope and Fear in the Social Smartphone Era.
Well, a mere 40 years. I joined the BBC as a fresh-faced youngster in September 1981. Effectively, I reported on technology for about 20 years, but I was officially named technology correspondent in 2007, so which is quite a good time to start, I have to say.
Well, a little bit before that, about 10 years before that, it's pure coincidence, but I might have been down the hall from you. I think the business unit was down. I worked in the World Television in the television centre there in West London, and I think you guys were just down the hall with the likes of Richard Quest and I think Adam Curtis and others. So you will have seen the web develop through, you know, Web 1.0, a digital version of publishing stuff that otherwise would have been printed, then two-way Web 2.0, people could interact with it. Now Mark Zuckerberg is promising us a metaverse in about 5 years' time. All this must be pretty dizzying to have gone all the way through this as a tech reporter.
Yeah, I mean, you're so immersed in it that you don't often step back and think about that. But yeah, I got my first proper home computer in 1995 and hooked it up to the internet and got the family round the screen, and we all stood there absolutely bewitched by it, because a picture from the Louvre Museum in Paris, which was one of the very early websites, animated onto the screen, and we all thought it was magic. From then on, the funny thing was, I usually had better technology at home than at work. You know, like all big organizations, the BBC was reasonably slow at giving people, you know, the state-of-the-art technology. And I think that was a general shift in the world, that people who were interested in it began to have, you know, better technology at their disposal than their bosses were going to give them. So I watched it grow even before it was my job to watch it grow.
Well, in your book, you talk a bit about this, because being immersed in it, that's one of the problems, isn't it? Standing back and trying to work out, you know, what's nuts and bolts, what's details, you know, what's the nerdy stuff, and what is of genuine significance. And you may be sick of the anecdote now, but you had to front up. You were complained about for reporting the iPhone launch for the BBC, because people said, this is publicity, this is a product launch. You have later said, look, effectively, we didn't know it at the time, this is, you know, the Model T Ford of tech.
Yeah, I was there in the hall in 2007, January 2007. I'd just been officially named technology correspondent. And I was there when Steve Jobs unveiled the iPhone in the most extraordinary performance, which at first, as a kind of cynical British journalist, I was a bit kind of, oh, please, when he said, we're going to make history here today. And we had this extraordinary crowd of people cheering and hollering and yelling, which is not a very British way of behaving. But gradually, during that hour and a half session of this masterful presentation, I was captivated. What was shown to us was so different from what we'd seen before in terms of mobile technology that I was captivated, and so were my bosses, actually. Well, at least a producer in London rang me and said, you've got to get your hand on that phone. And I did get my hands on that phone somehow. And yes, there were complaints to the BBC when we put it on the nightly news, the 10 o'clock news, that this was just a product launch. And yes, I stuck my neck out and said, well, what about if the BBC had been around when Henry Ford unveiled the Model T Ford? Would that have just been a product launch? No, it was the beginning of the automotive age, the age of popular motoring. Maybe this will be the beginning of another era. And luckily, I was proved right. I'm not being right about everything, but it was a moment in history, because that turned out to be the most profitable single product in history, the iPhone. And it launched this smartphone era, which we're seeing the consequences of even today.
Indeed. Well, the book is subtitled Hope and Fear in the Social Smartphone Era. Can you, at this point in your career and your long vantage point, can you say where the balance is? Should we be hopeful or fearful of where it's all heading?
Well, I think we go through this with all new technologies. I mean, we went through it with radio, for heaven's sake. People thought that that would corrupt youth, and obviously television. I grew up in the age when parents used to say to children, why don't you switch off the television and go do something more useful instead? This is, frankly, a much more powerful, much more immersive, much more interactive technology, which has its pluses and definitely its minuses. And we've seen that in recent weeks with what we've learned about Facebook, the most powerful of those social networks, which I describe as in the book as forming the social smartphone era, because it's the combination of those networks with these brilliant devices that has forced through so much change. So we are seeing the damaging effects. I heard a great expert on artificial intelligence the other night giving a lecture in which he compared Facebook and what it had been doing to Chernobyl as a kind of wake-up call to the dangers of this particular technology, which may be going it a bit. But I am concerned. I share people's concerns, but I still feel that A, it's inevitable, and B, that I'm a glass half full person. I see lots of positives to this technology, particularly highlighted by what's happened over the last 18 months, where, frankly, those of us who've been locked, as I have been for long stretches in my loft in West London, wouldn't have been without that kind of connectivity.
Absolutely. Yes, that's Professor Stuart Russell you referred to there, who was giving the Reith lectures about the threats and possibilities of AI.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Reith lectures cover all sorts of areas. It's matters of public policy, matters of public concern, and obviously technology and artificial intelligence, which is another sort of theme of my book in particular, are hugely important right now. And I think these lectures will give a fascinating insight into, again, the hopes and fears surrounding that technology.
Well, Rory, you mentioned there Facebook are currently in the gun here. They're facing a lot of heat after the revelations in the Wall Street Journal and Francis Hogan and so on. In your book, you recall an interview with a Facebook executive, and you observe that the company, its founder, were not arrogant, but didn't seem to need or feel the need for external advice. And this is many years back, right, that you have this particular encounter. But I wonder, is that still it? Are they incapable of looking at themselves and thinking, are we the baddies?
He has got a track record, Mark Zuckerberg, of being, to be charitable, a bit late in recognizing the power of his platform and its capacity to cause harm. I don't know if you remember, but very shortly after Donald Trump was elected in 2016, he was at some public event where he just laughed at the idea that fake news on Facebook could have played any role in the election. And he had to kind of take that back. He reminds me of the kind of the boy in the Sorcerer's Apprentice with the mops and the ever-rising tide of water, completely incapable of controlling what his creation has become. And the other concerning thing about it, of course, is that he has got almost unlimited power. He's not like any other chief executive. He's got a sort of controlling stake, the way the share structure works. He's sort of unsackable. I mean, it served him very well in the early days. I mean, when I first met him in 2008, it was just 4 years in, and I was foolish enough to suggest that he should have sold up when he was offered $1 billion for the company. Of course, now
he was 24 years old at the time.
That was not that. Yeah, he was 24 years old at the time. He could have relaxed. He could have kicked back, but he said, "No. What would I do?" And of course, it's now a $1 trillion company, or it is at times a $1 trillion company, but. It was that single-mindedness which built Facebook, that whenever he was told, you know, to bring in, quotes, adult supervision, to do things differently, he had his own vision. I think the interview you're referring to was with a guy called Chris Cox, mm-hmm. who was his sort of sidekick, and he's still at the company and really important. And he told me back in 2010 that Zuckerberg was like a man from the future who comes back and tells us that everything's going to be cool. And everything's going to be awesome. And the trouble is, we no longer quite believe that everything in Facebook's world is quite so cool or awesome.
At the time, also, no one could have assumed how much this platform and people's social media habits and online habits would actually intersect with the news media, with journalism. A lot of people were in short order getting their news via Facebook feeds. And another startling part of your book is that early on there was quite a few people, I think, even within the company, saying that this actually wasn't a tremendously popular function, and some even suggested turning it off. They didn't like all these recommendations from either sources or friends and family, you know, popping up and intruding on their online experience. But it really has become a critical avenue for the news media, which has affected the viability of commercial media companies all over the world.
Yeah, and it's been a very difficult relationship because Facebook has not been, quote, a constant sort of friend, as it were, to the news media. It blows hot and cold. So I think news organizations are in a very difficult position because they know that this is the way to reach a huge audience and they've got to be there. But policy can change in a moment. So there was an incident a few years back where Facebook said, right, video is going to be hugely important. We're going to have a pivot to video. And news organizations, many of them, started changing their workforces so that there were loads of people working on video and other people were kind of heaved over the side. And then after a few months, Facebook had a look and revealed rather sort of guiltily that actually nobody's watching those videos. So we're gonna change again. And all those news organizations which had made those big investments were in a hole. And of course, they couldn't afford to be in that kind of hole.
Now, when in recent days we've seen Mark Zuckerberg himself, almost Steve Jobs style, announcing the metaverse and the rebranding of the company, which, you know, cynics would say, well, that's what companies do when their brand has become toxic. You know, they'll change the name and try to point people's attention elsewhere. However, this is clearly something he's planning on. I mean, when he says this could be within 5 years, we'll be living in this metaverse, I mean, the actual communications, the video just seem kind of laughable almost, you know, the him and his mates in that sort of cartoon household. And also there are interviews we've seen, internal ones, where he's talking to his own colleagues and they're having these extremely inauthentic conversations about how awesome everything is going to be. And you want to laugh at it. However, look at the track record of what it's achieved. Does the news media have to assume we've got to take this seriously? We could be operating in a kind of universe of which Mark Zuckerberg and his company will be huge in shaping it?
I do think we have to take it seriously, even though, you know, I share some of the skepticism around it. So, I mean, this is not a new idea. I mean, I don't know if you remember something called Second Life, which was a kind of virtual world.
Mm-hmm.
And a news organization did actually post some poor reporter to that virtual world. Reuters took one of their reporters and changed his name to Adam Reuters and made him live in Second Life and report stories from there, which didn't last long. The truth is, we are living more of our lives online, you know, as my book shows, you know, the amount of time we spend looking at our phones, WhatsApping, Facebooking, Instagramming, TikToking is growing and growing. At the moment, it's a 2D experience. And, you know, what Mark Zuckerberg is saying is it will be a 3D experience and a much more immersive experience. The trouble is, you have to get people at the moment accepting the idea of putting on a headset to do that. So far, that has proved to be quite a niche activity. The sort of $64 billion question is whether that will become a general activity, wanting to spend time in virtual worlds. And I'm still a bit skeptical that without some huge technological breakthrough that makes it less clunky, many people will want to do that.
I mean, is there every possibility that people themselves will reject it? They just won't want it. And they won't want Facebook and that company with its track record having an even bigger role in their lives? Or alternatively, will there come a tipping point where governments, regulators say, we cannot put up with this sort of dominance? It's too dangerous. It's too anti-democratic, if that's not too dramatic, to have one company with all this influence on the technology we use.
Well, I certainly think that there'll be a lot of pushback about Meta, running the metaverse, given its track record. And it's been interesting to see that Mark Zuckerberg has very much been stressing, oh, this is going to be a kind of open source democratic space where, you know, no one company will control the standards. He has got a head start in this vision. There was some skepticism when he bought Oculus, the virtual reality company, but that now seems to have been a good move. So he will have the power to shape that metaverse if it is going to become a big thing. And I think regulators will have to be looking very closely at his influence. But there is still the wider question of whether people will be comfortable with the experience in general. And I don't think that's a given.
Well, if we turn back again to the news media and the role of journalism and its future, I mean, you mentioned there that Facebook blows hot and cold on the media and journalism. I wonder, at times they seem very ambivalent to it, but at all times, and like all the big tech platforms, they've been very anxious not to be put into a corner of given the responsibilities of being a publisher. They say we're merely a platform. We've seen Australia, our near neighbours, really confronting the likes of Google and Facebook and pretty much pushing them into the position of having to pay Australian news media to run and distribute their stories. Yeah, are we likely to see more of that? Journalism media has a social function and that they actually have to do a bit more because of the influence they wield over it?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was very interesting, that Australian case, because the sort of wise people of the internet, as it were, whether or not they liked Facebook, thought that was a terrible idea, that, you know, you couldn't force people to carry your material, which effectively it was doing. But Australia's sort of gamble seemed to come off and has, I think, inspired governments around the world who will be looking closely at that. In the end, though, it's going to be pocket money to the likes of Facebook and Google. And they may, you know, they may grumble about it, but they won't be too worried because they won't see it as a major threat to their business models. These are two businesses which, what they've captured in an extraordinary fashion, is the mobile advertising industry, which has become the dominant industry, the fuel for the whole sort of mobile internet, which obviously is a huge business. And while they've got that kind of control, they won't worry about being asked to send a few dollars to this news organization or that.
Yeah, mobile advertising used to mean, you know, a sign on the side of a van being towed around town and parked by the railway station, didn't it? Not anymore.
Yeah, I mean, the fascinating thing, I was looking the other day at what Facebook said in its IPO when it floated its shares back in 2012. There was a risk factor in that document saying, as the world goes mobile, maybe, you know, our advertising won't work in the mobile world. And of course, it very much did. And it became the way it made money. And that is why Google and Facebook are such hugely powerful companies today. We often forget what a huge empire it is. It's not just Facebook, it's WhatsApp, which itself has all sorts of issues in terms of spreading conspiracy theories and ethnic abuse and so on. And Instagram, which again is incredibly powerful in terms of teenagers in particular. And then there's Oculus, which, as we've discussed, is increasingly becoming its focus as it moves into the metaverse. But generally, despite all the talk, the kind of happy clappy talk 10 years ago that the internet was a different place, a place without borders where everyone was equal, they would still wait for California to wake up before giving you an answer to a question. And that could take quite some time. And Facebook are by far from the worst. I mean, the most controlling company on earth is Apple, which has had what's been a very effective policy for it of hardly ever doing any interviews at all. I certainly didn't have an interview in the last decade with anybody from Apple because they do not think it's worth engaging outside the United States.
Well, in an episode of the BBC's media show, I talked to one person who was from the website Politico in the US, and her job title was Tech Lobbying Reporter, Emily Birnbaum. And at first when I heard that, I kind of chuckled. I thought, what a hilarious job title. But actually, I mean, the fact that these companies have grown in the way they have, that they're so lightly regulated in a lot of countries, including New Zealand, it really is something that I think demands having a correspondent dedicated to it, because somehow by the lobbying or just by the skill and attractiveness of their products combined with lobbying, they really have avoided the sort of regulation that even big outfits like Microsoft have faced in the past.
Yeah, I mean, the tide has obviously turned in the last couple of years, and there is a determination in lots of countries to crack down. In the UK, we've got this online safety bill making its way through Parliament. But there are huge problems for regulation because, frankly, no country wants to stifle its own innovative businesses. And, you know, you can't have regulation that applies to one company and not another. So let's not pretend it's an easy route to go down.
Well, speaking of not taking the easy route, the whole last part of your book, Always On, Rory, tech in a health crisis. So I'm guessing that when you offered this book to your publisher or decided what to write, you weren't planning on writing a whole part of the book on that. Well, I mean, great that you did it, because this is really something where the rubber meets the road, isn't it? A global crisis like this. And then we find out both the pros and cons of having these platforms, you know, with such reach across the globe, don't we?
Yeah, well, I mean, the interesting thing was when the publishers came and discussed this book with me in 2019, late 2019, the last whole section of the book was going to be about health, but it was going to be about my health. I've got various health challenges and my optimism that technology could play a role. And then as I was writing it, the global pandemic came along, trapped me in my attic here and gave me plenty of food for thought and plenty of stories about, A, as you say, the negatives and the positive sides of technology during a pandemic, but also about the nitty-gritty of using technology to, for instance, track people's contacts using apps to try and battle COVID-19.
Yeah, extraordinary. And you found that you had Parkinson's disease a few years back, also cancer as well. And then social network kind of amplify people's, you know, knowledge of what to me is your personal private medical situation. But has it actually been a help in the end?
Well, yeah. I mean, I made a conscious decision in the middle of 2019, a few months after I'd been diagnosed. Somebody said to me, a producer said to me, because I'd been seen on TV with my hand shaking, have you thought of going public? And I said, yeah, I thought about it and let's do it. And I put out a tweet explaining that I had been diagnosed with Parkinson's. And it was hugely positive. I got a great reaction, got a lot of support. I then made it part of my journalism, at least, to look, for instance, at the technology which is emerging that could use smartphones and other sensors to track Parkinson's disease and other conditions. So for me, it's been positive, both in both personally and in my journalism. And I've also found that other people who've got it sort of welcome that, because there's been a tendency to be quite secretive about the condition. People in some jobs are worried that, you know, frankly, they might get fired if their boss knew that they'd been diagnosed with this. They might be seen as not really up to their job. So I think it has been positive.
It's Rory Kethlen-Jones, who retired from the BBC this week after more than 20 years of covering technology, and he's the author of a new book about all that called Always On, Hope and Fear in the Social Smartphone Era, in which he deals, among other things, with a lot of that bad PR that Facebook is dealing with at the moment.